Welcome to Let's Talk FCA, presented by Cole and Maury. We're your co-hosts, Mona Lombardo and Jason Crawford, bringing you the latest developments with the False Claims Act.
Thanks, Mona. Today we're joined by special guest Will Chang. Will is a partner in Kroll's healthcare and white collar and regulatory enforcement groups. Prior to joining the firm's DC office, he served as a trial attorney with the fraud section of DOJ's criminal division. Will was a founding member of the Corporate Healthcare Fraud Strike Force, which investigates the largest and most sophisticated healthcare fraud cases nationwide. Will has extensive experience trying fraud cases and leading multi-agency investigations of companies and individuals, and so we are excited to get his take on recent FCA developments. Welcome, Will.
Good morning.
Will, can you start by describing the work of the Corporate Healthcare Fraud Strike Force and why it was created?
Sure. The Corporate Healthcare Fraud Strike Force is part of the Criminal Division Fraud Section. What it does is it investigates and prosecutes criminal healthcare fraud schemes that spans across multiple jurisdictions. And its targets are usually larger providers. These are, for example, a health system that operates over 100 facilities in multiple states. As to why it was created, my partner, Laura Cordova, founded the Corporate Healthcare Fraud Strike Force in 2015, and I was one of the founding members because there was no part of the Department of Justice and certainly not any other healthcare fraud prosecuting body thus positioned to tackle these type of large, multi-jurisdictional cases. The Criminal Division Fraud Section was extremely well positioned to do so because it had access to all the real-time investigation evidence being gathered across the Strike Force cities in several states, as well as its partnerships with the Medicaid Fraud Control Units in the 50 states.
So, well, what types of companies are most frequently targeted for fraud investigations in the healthcare space? And what are some of the common fact patterns?
I've reviewed about the last 50 most recently unsealed key TAMs in the healthcare space. And healthcare continues to be the largest portion of the FCA annual recoveries. It's about two-thirds. The top targets in the healthcare FCA space continues to be pharma and medical device companies, hospitals and hospital systems, as well as post-acute care being home health and hospice. In 2017, a new thing that we saw was electronic health records with a $155 million settlement with eClinical Works. EHR vendors are companies that help medical providers take advantage of HHS's meaningful use program, which was recently renamed Promoting Interoperability. On the criminal side, prosecutions continue to focus mainly on small operators and individuals. It's changing somewhat with the DOJ's Corporate Healthcare Fraud Strike Force and its expanding operations. As far as subject areas, the mainstays continue to be post-acute care, but the development that the Department of Justice and its law enforcement partners in the states and with other agencies has recently seen is that in the post-acute care, in addition to home health and hospice services, there has also been an uptick in fraud involving personal attendant services. Traditionally, this has been paid under Medicaid. And what investigations have been uncovering is that there are a significant number of overlaps and beneficiaries across fraud schemes in these three types of benefit programs, hospice, home health, and personal attendant services, by overlap simultaneously enrolled in perhaps two of those programs or cycling of beneficiaries among those three programs. Opioids, of course, continues to be a high priority for the department, and that's been very well publicized. In the criminal space, it continues to focus on pill mills and individual providers, and Part D fraud as well as compounding fraud continues to be a focus of the criminal investigations as well. A common fact pattern occurring across both the False Claims Act and criminal prosecutions is kickbacks. It seems to be at least in half, if not more than half, the key TAMs filed, whether it's in hospital space, medical device space, pharma space, or in the criminal investigations, home health, hospitals, ambulances, etc. So whether it's paying recruiters, paying physicians, paying beneficiaries, or paying any other person or entity in a position to generate referrals, kickbacks is a consistent mainstay in both the criminal and civil prosecutions.
Will, can you describe how the government is able to utilize healthcare data in order to identify cases for investigation, and how that data is being used in the actual prosecution of cases?
So by data, I'm assuming you mean claims data, you know, provided by Medicare or other payers. And the answer is, it really is a beginning to end use of claims data. At the very beginning of an investigation, claims data can be instrumental in identifying potential targets because of aberrant billing patterns, for example. Or something even more obvious, claims data can tell you who's billing for beneficiaries who are dead, right? But all throughout the process, as the investigation progresses, the investigation will cover additional evidence, witnesses, medical records, and financial records from the banks. If they all line up, if the aberrant billing pattern, if the entity that is prescribing the treatment that is causing the aberrant billing pattern, it has a financial relationship with the entity that is actually billing to Medicare that treatment, that's further evidence that, in fact, there's fraud or even potential kickback arrangement. So it's really, as the investigation goes, if all these ducks are lining up and telling one consistent story, that will convince the prosecutor to go and prosecute, take it to the grand jury. And later on, that's exactly how these cases are presented at trial.
So jumping off from that point, Will, at what point does a false claims case cross the line from being a civil matter to a criminal matter? And how does that affect defense counsel's strategies in cases that could turn criminal?
At the Department of Justice, both the criminal component as well as the civil component have a role in the intake of False Claims Act cases. At Maine Justice, and I know in many United States Attorney's offices, the healthcare fraud coordinator on the criminal side will frequently review key TAMs that are filed, because often those key TAMs on their face also lay out all the elements of a criminal healthcare fraud scheme or a kickback scheme. So it's one way in which something that's an issue filed as a key TAM might go criminal, because it actually lays out a criminal scheme. Especially when the prosecutor then looks at that key TAM and examines other data points that the prosecutor has access to, such as ongoing investigations and evidence collected in those investigations, as well as claims data that the office might be running on various types of billing patterns and sectors, and it overlaps with the key TAM to corroborate what the key TAM and the relator is saying. Now, the second way in which a case could go criminal is if it involves patient harm. Third way is if there's any falsified medical records. Again, those are things that makes a case much easier to understand and prove to a criminal jury. And the fourth is existence of legal kickbacks. And finally, opioids. If there's diversion, especially when it's coupled with criminal patient harm as well as kickbacks, it makes it much more likely to go criminal. One last thing that's often overlooked in determining whether a healthcare fraud case is more likely to be handled on the criminal versus the civil side is what prosecuting entity is handling the case. Certain components of the Department of Justice, certain United States Attorney's offices, certain Medicaid fraud control units on the state side have a much deeper bench handling criminal healthcare fraud cases. Historically, most components have a much deeper bench handling healthcare fraud on the civil side. But that bench is developing also on the criminal side, with much deeper benches across more and more United States attorneys' offices, especially as we have 10 years now of partnerships with the United States attorneys' offices in the criminal division's criminal healthcare fraud unit.
How about individual accountability? What factors will prompt the department to bring a case not just against a company, but individual owners or employees?
So I would really reframe that question, and not in terms of what would prompt the department to bring a case not just against the company, but also against individual owners or employees, but the other way around. What would prompt the department to bring a case not just against individuals, but also a company? And there are a couple of documents to look at which provide the guidance to prosecutors. I mean, this is not a secret. One is in the United States Attorney's Manual. It's called The Principles of Federal Prosecution of Business Organizations, and the other main document is the Yates Memo. A lot has been talked about and published about both guidance documents. The directive to all prosecutors, whether civil or criminal, is to focus first and foremost on individual accountability. And that makes sense because fraud does not occur whether on the civil side or the criminal side without individuals driving it. Now, the second question is what factors would really cause a department to bring a case against a company rather than just focusing on the individuals? Again, those factors are publicly available in those documents I've just talked about. A couple of them is the nature and seriousness of the offense, how pervasive is the wrongdoing within the company, is there history of similar wrongdoing in the company? Bottom line is, did the company learn from its past mistakes, or is this a company that does not take compliance seriously? But there's really one super factor that's been getting a lot of attention from DOJ leadership and has been part of outreach efforts, and that is the compliance program. Without a strong compliance program, a lot of these other factors are just not possible. A company can't have a strong tone from the top. The company will not have a strong history of disclosure, and often won't even be in a position to fully disclose to the regulators or law enforcement agencies without a dynamic and robust compliance program.
On our last podcast, we discussed the DOJ memorandum known as the Brand Memo, which focused on the use of agency guidance documents in affirmative civil enforcement cases. What sort of impact do you think the Brand Memo will have in healthcare FCA cases?
Well, I think for me, the big open question rests on footnote one in the Brand Memo and the nature of how Medicare works. The footnote one of the Brand Memo explains that guidance refers to sub-regulatory guidance of general application. Well, for any provider who enters the Medicare program, that provider signs a contract saying that the provider will abide by all laws, regulations, and instructions of the Medicare program. And instructions is really broad enough to cover all sub-regulatory guidance. And by signing that contract, arguably that provider has agreed that it will follow all sub-regulatory guidance in that specific instance. So the argument goes that for that provider, in that contract, guidance is no longer of general application and therefore falls out of the ambit of the Brand Memo. And if that's true, the Brand Memo will have very limited application in the healthcare space. So that's one open question. I personally question whether that would make sense, because that type of interpretation would really undermine the purpose of the Brand Memo. But as of yet, I still have not seen a definitive answer on that question. The other big piece is on kickbacks in the Brand Memo, which we discussed earlier. I don't see the Brand Memo having a significant impact on how kickbacks or how the department investigates kickbacks and prosecutes kickback cases. And that's because the kickback statute and safe harbors are mostly controlled by statutes and regulations, not sub-regulatory guidance.
So in closing, Will, are there any enforcement hotspots that you think our audience should be aware of?
I don't see much of a deviation on the FCA side from historic trends. Like I mentioned before, medical device, pharma, hospitals, hospital systems, post-acute care. I think we will see a continuation from the 2017 enforcement efforts against electronic health record vendors, just given the emphasis in the shift right now that Secretary Azar has made about promoting interoperability. That means the incentive payments to medical providers for meaningful use are going to be much more attractive. And whenever there's such a large pot of money to be gained, there's going to be people who cheat. Recent reports from HHS strongly indicate that EHR and meaningful use will be subject to close scrutiny. For hotspots, I would think not just in terms of the space that you're in, you know, medical device versus pharma, really look at the locations as well. There's a reason, I mean, this is available on the fraud section's website and other publicly available information. There is a reason why the Department of Justice has opened up healthcare fraud strike force cities and invested so much resources, not just in investigators and prosecutors across the nation. It's because the claims data and the investigations spending over the last decade have identified those regions as places that have lots of fraudulent operations historically and currently in progress. So if I'm a provider and I operate in those regions, I'd also pay extra scrutiny and work to strengthen the compliance programs to deal with the frauds in those regions.
Well, thank you very much, Will, for joining us today and sharing your thoughts on FCA trends in the healthcare space today. That's all for this episode. Looking ahead to next month, as many of our listeners may know, June 16th marks the two-year anniversary of the Supreme Court's landmark decision in Universal Health Services versus USX Rel Escobar, the Escobar decision. And to mark that occasion, on our June podcast, we'll be taking a close look at how Escobar has affected FCA litigation, and we'll be discussing where the road ahead may lead. In the meantime, if you need anything, I can be reached at 213-443-5563. And Jason at 202-624-2562. We'll see you next month.
Let's Talk FCA is brought to you by Kroll & Mooring LLP. You can find more information at kroll.com/podcasts.